Hello, and welcome to the Panzer Podcast. My name is John Burgess, and I will be your host today as we deep dive into all things tanks. On today's Labor Day edition episode, we will further our narrative into the development of the American Medium Tank Program. Last episode, we set the foundation and the backdrop of the 1919 Ordnance Program. We had a chance to cover four prototype vehicles, the Ordnance Department's own M1921 and M1922 tanks, along with J. Walter Christie's M1919 and the M1921 wheeled and tracked medium tanks, which, as was noted, were quite prototypey in that they were primitive versions of what we all imagine when we say medium tank. That's okay. We're still in the 1920s, and the idea of the Second World War is still kind of far away. So, my plan for these history lesson episodes, that is, the research and development phase, we are going to continue along the timeline further and chase in detail the good, the bad, and the rejected outright prototype medium tanks of the 1919 Ordnance Program. We're going to start noticing more and more overlap as we go from one prototype to the next. This will feel different from how the Panther prototype process went, mostly due to the urgency of each program. Ultimately, one of the major failings of the Panther was that it did not have the opportunity to go through nearly two decades worth of prototype and testing. The tanks that the U.S. Army entered the war with had been vetted as thoroughly as they could be without actual combat experience. We'll get to the first deployment of the Sherman when that time arises, but trust me, it wasn't great. Though, with that said, nothing is ever perfect. It's just that the final product of these years of research, development, trials, and errors would have substantially more success than vehicles with less exhaustive R&D. Which sounds obvious, but I feel the need to point it out. The flip side of that coin is that some of the overlooked weaknesses could also sow more condemnation. Sounds too philosophical of a thought for a podcast about tanks, so let's get back to the topic at hand and have a look around at these next-in-line medium tank prototypes. The lessons learned at the end of the Ordnance Department's M1921 medium tank testing phase was the failure of the Murray and Tregurtha marine engine. Marine engine. Curious. Was this engine a jarhead? No, not that kind of marine. Marine as in a boat engine. I suppose maybe I buried that lead in the previous episode. What can I say? I have a flair for the dramatic. So, much like a bad M. Night movie, the twist is simply that the Murray and Tregurtha was garbage in this application. I'm not an engineering type, nor am I a mechanic, but something tells me boat engines and tank engines have, you know, some subtle crossover that make them similar, yet I'm sure they are quite different. Regardless, Murray and Tregurtha was fucking out, and Packard was fucking in, as told by Kenny Powers. The Ordnance Department set out looking for commercially available engines that could fill the role of powering the latest and greatest medium tanks of the U.S. Army. Unfortunately, none existed. At least, none that would satisfy the needs of the Ordnance Department. And so, a contract was awarded to the Packard Motor Company, whom you might recognize Packard as the specially fitted 200 horsepower, 8-cylinder engine that was installed in a last-ditch attempt at saving the M1921 and M1922 prototypes. That engine itself was actually completed in 1925, mostly completed, and by 1926 it was modified to fit into the M1921 and the M1922 mediums, but was actually designed and fitted for the Phase 2 medium tank, quickly redesignated the medium tank T1. I would like to pause the T1 story for just a moment and put a spotlight on the Packard Motor Company. For two reasons. One, they are an interesting piece of American automotive history. And secondly, I've got a bit of a personal anecdote about the Packard Motor Company and my great uncle. Founded in 1898 by brothers James and William Packard, was born out of an almost mythological beginning. Legend has it, James Packard purchased a Winton automobile, which, at the time, were considered quite good cars. James, however, was a mechanical engineer and observed a lot of, issues with his Winton. He returned the vehicle, visibly disgusted, commenting to Winton himself, who famously retorted, "Well, come up with a better car." And you know what? A year later, the Packard brothers had created their first automobile, a one-cylinder car. Huzzah. Originally known as the Ohio Automobile Company, the company changed its name in 1903 when they moved to Detroit, Michigan, to the Packard Motor Company. The early 1900s are a fascinating period in American history, not in the least bit because of the barnstorming era that existed during this period. We had mentioned barnstorming briefly when discussing Walter Christie in the previous episode, but it really was such a phenomenon of the era that it's worth detailing just a little further. For people like Christie or the Packard brothers, it was important to demonstrate your product more than it was to just talk about it. Television ads did not exist yet because televisions did not exist. I mean, hell, Marconi's first radio broadcast wasn't until 1895. Experimental broadcast radio didn't come around till 1905. And realistically, it was not until the 1920s when broadcast radio became a widespread thing for Americans. So how did you advertise in the early 1900s? Barnstorming. That's it. Simply. I mean, there were other methods as well, but barnstorming was, without busting out the old Oxford's Dictionary, was the practice of taking your product to the people, directly. The term was broadened over the years to include things like aeronautic acrobat shows, athletes, you know, sprinting, jumping, cross-continental races, and even political campaigns. So the Packard brothers, being a product of their time, took to the trend and would prove the reliability of their Packard cars by driving cross-country and taking first place in several reliability tests and endurance races. They would stop in rural towns to show off their fantastic machines, and in 1919, Ralph De Palma set the land speed record in his 12-cylinder Packard at Daytona Beach. He reached speeds of 149 miles per hour. That's 240 kilometers an hour for the rest of you. Pretty impressive for that time. However, the Great War changed the trajectory of the company as they in turn focused on marine and aircraft engines to meet the demand of the War Department. They managed to stay quite profitable through to the end of the war and even survived the Great Depression with various government contracts. Notably, in the 1920s, winning the Ordnance Department's contract to construct the new medium tank engine for the T-1 program. Skipping ahead to 1942, the U.S. government had ordered all car companies to focus their efforts on war-related projects. The Packard Motor Company, answering the call, would go right back into the construction of marine, airplane, and now tank engines, as well as various military vehicles. They would produce some 60,000 motors by the end of the war, earning themselves $30 million in profits. They would return after the war to producing luxury vehicles such as their flagship Clipper series, which includes the Clipper 6 2100, the 2103 of 1946 vintage, along with the Super Clipper and the Custom Super Clipper. In 1947 through 1949, Packard would produce the Super 8 and the Super 8 Deluxe. All of these vehicles scream Cruella de Vil, or like Grease Lightning. They're very cool to look at, and if you ever come across like an oldies classic car show, you are almost guaranteed to see some Packards. The good times would not last much longer after the war. In an attempt to cut production cost and take advantage of a larger market, the company merged with Studebaker in 1954. The company's automobile plant in South Bend, Indiana, would close shortly thereafter in 1958. Now that is the Cliff Notes version of the Packard Motor Company story, but I just want to shine a little bit more light here, which is where my personal anecdote comes in. As the story goes, my great uncle, my grandfather's older brother, having just recently graduated high school in South Bend, Indiana, and wanting a well-paying job, decided to take a position at the Packard plant. Uncle Jim, always a lover of vehicles and feats of engineering, was excited to work on the factory floor. In a bit of a fortunate and also quite unfortunate incident, he witnessed very early on in his career, like the first week or two, a fellow manufacturer on the assembly floor was crushed and killed instantly by some heavy piece of machinery. This prompted Uncle Jim to walk into his supervisor's office and resign on the spot. He would in turn decide that he wanted to work for Packard still, just not anywhere near the assembly line, and enrolled at Purdue to pursue his mechanical engineering degree. He would unfortunately not have a chance to work as an engineer for Packard, as they would be closing down by the time he finished college, but instead would end up working for Studebaker before they ultimately closed down for good as well. All right, side story finished. Now, back to the T1 prototype. The medium tank T1, completed in May of 1927 by the Rock Island Armory, this new test vehicle was to be produced using soft steel instead of hardened plate, which might sound counterintuitive at first, but I would like to remind the listener that during these lean times, the Army and Ordnance Department were working from, you know, a rather shoestring budget, and as such needed to cut cost in every possible way, while still maintaining and producing some viable prototypes. After all, they are still trying to build the next tank for the U.S. Army to use in the next, inevitable, I suppose, war. Soft steel, that is, steel that was not manufactured to the more precise and involved forging process that hardened steel that makes up armor plates would be. It was, however, just as heavy, or close enough. The primary contributing factor to using softer steel, and obviously, soft steel does not mean it's like a fluffy pillow to lay your head on. It is still metal plate. It just does not carry the same properties and defensive capabilities as would the hardened armor plate of a war-ready vehicle. The reason they were using this soft steel was simply a way to save money. And I'm not talking $5 or, you know, a little bit of money. The cost of producing the T1 in soft steel was only $5,200, or $88,500 in 2022 money. Inflation's kind of fun. Compared to the whopping $52,000 it would have probably cost to manufacture an armored plate. Just for fun, the inflation calculator says that that is actually $885,000 in 2022 funny money. Just for a little bit of a comparison, the Panther tank cost 117,000 Reichsmarks, or in today's money, nothing, because Reichsmarks ceased to exist in 1945. Kidding aside, the relative comparative cost of a Panther in US dollars would be about $46,840 in 1943. Adjusting for inflation, that is about $802,000. So, in terms of saving money, using soft steel cuts down a considerable amount, to the tune of 10 times in realistic terms. So, it made sense to create prototype vehicles out of softer, mild steel, which is exactly what the production folks at Rock Island Armory did when they built the medium tank T1. This prototype, which would eventually arrive at Aberdeen in September of 1927 for its testing purposes. The T1 prototype weighed in at about 22 tons, 21.95 tons to be exact, or 43,900 pounds, which was a tad bit heavier than the M1921 medium tank, the one produced by RIA, or Rock Island Armory. With this brand new bespoke design Packard engine, the T1 boasted a power-to-weight ratio of 9 horsepower per ton, falling just a little bit short of General Rockenbach's 1919 requirements of 10 horsepower per ton. This new Packard engine was as American as Marlboro Reds, noted as being rugged and dependable, albeit still somewhat underpowered. It did not break down as frequently, nor did it require the precise maintenance and deft handling like that of the Murray and Jugurtha engine. The average speed was demonstrated to be 11.25 miles per hour, or 18 kilometers per hour. Though reading the report in front of me, the T1 managed a speed of 14 miles per hour, or 22.5 kilometers per hour. Though just the one time it did that, and it may have had a little bit of help from our friend called Gravity and a steep incline. The T1, in appearance, was essentially the same as the M1921, save for the engine, the rear deck of the engine, which had differently shaped engine louvers. Essentially, those are the exhaust and the cooling system of the engine. It was enlarged to allow better airflow and thus better performance. On January 24th of 1928, both the Aberdeen Proving Grounds and the Tank Board were decidedly impressed with the T1, and they approved her for standardization. She would be designated the Medium Tank M1 on February 2nd of 1928. This was to be a rather short-lived tank in the U.S. arsenal, as it was withdrawn in mere months, barely breaking into spring before being completely scratched from the roster. Though the medium tank M1 was now dead, the sole prototype, the T1 vehicle, continued service as a testing bed for a new 75mm pack howitzer. The M1920 pack howitzer, that is, and by July of 1928, the 6-pounder, the 57mm, was removed and this new mount was installed. The M1920 pack howitzer, famously pictured on the back of a horse, scope out the Instagram post for this episode. And for those wondering what the difference between a pack and non-pack howitzer, well, it's kind of in the name. A pack howitzer is any howitzer, or really, you could say pack artillery, is any artillery piece which is designed and meant to be broken down into smaller pieces and carried by either infantry or draft animals like donkeys, mules, horses, or GIs. Essentially, a pack howitzer will be of lighter construction, usually a smaller round, something like a 75mm versus like a 105 or a 155, or if you're German or Russian, 200, 300mm cannons. This smaller and lighter howitzer will have a more limited range and capability due to the usually shorter and smaller barrel. Generally speaking, and this does not apply to all applications of a pack howitzer, but the idea was to give mountain troops, light infantry, cavalry, and even later on, paratroopers, the ability to increase their indirect fire capabilities while not entirely bogging them down with heavier equipment like tractors or trucks to haul these howitzers. Also, for situations like mountain and airborne operations, the ability to tow artillery might simply be not feasible, not going to happen. So pack howitzers remedied this situation, although decreasing the size and weight of the howitzer does come with detractive qualities, kind of like a Fallout perk. There's a plus side, and there's also a negative side to this. The positive being that there is now a 75mm howitzer installed on the T1. The negative is a reduction in muzzle velocity. The powder charge of the M1920 howitzer was reduced quite considerably, limiting the muzzle velocity to a mere 650 feet per second. Versus what the 6-pounder, or the 57mm cannon, which boasted a muzzle velocity of 1,818 feet per second, nearly thrice as fast. This was a stark contrast in firepower. However, it was noted that the M1920 pack howitzer simply obliterated the M1917 light tank during live fire test on the range. I would like to point out here as well that the pack howitzer, according to the Field Artillery Journal of May and June of 1931, describes the introduction and development of the pack howitzer as so. Quote, "The principal targets for the accompanying gun will be machine gun nest, infantry mortars, accompanying guns, anti-tank guns, and armored cars, which are considered to be exceptional targets for an accompanying gun as distinguished from an anti-tank gun." End quote. Side quest, the Field Artillery Branch of the U.S. Army was also conducting their own test and prototypes during the 1920s to advance the breadth and scope of artillery maneuvers. In the above quote, they referenced accompanying guns, which was another way to say pack guns, because in the ideas of the field artillery, howitzers and the like were the big and heavy towed artillery pieces. These accompanying guns were to bridge the gap between lighter infantry mortars and the heavier field guns like howitzers. The pack artillery was designed to advance with the infantry and keep up with them to support the immediate needs of the attack. They were used to knock out such things like the machine gun nest and other artillery that would otherwise be out of reach of the infantry until the field guns could be repositioned. This was 100% a direct result of after-action reporting from the Great War. You can read about this problem in Ernst Jünger's Storm of Steel, or Louis Barta's Poilu, or even Philip Gibbs' Now It Can Be Told. Infantry attacks during the Great War nearly always started off favorably for the attackers. For as long as their artillery could reach out and touch the enemy was bereft of their ability to safely fend off the onslaught. However, once the artillery ceased, as the infantry were either now too close, or the artillery simply could not reach past or further, the enemy would come out of their little hidey holes and start chipping away at the now beleaguered and caught in the open with their pants down infantry. Time and time again, the masses of infantry would be cut down without any viable or available support. Remember, the Great War armies, once they were outside the range of their support, were not too better off than Napoleonic armies marching towards one another. Albeit, machine guns and rifled barrels changed the dynamic greatly, favoring the defenders in these situations. But this problem, it persisted, and without new technology would stunt the idea of any proper assault. Artillery, while immensely destructive, was also quite limited by the inability to quickly reposition and move up within range of the enemy. And it wasn't just due to the weight of the guns. Obviously, roads were nearly impassable after a few weeks of frontline activity, especially on the front lines of, say, the Western Front. Not to mention things like counter-battery fire was an ever-present danger. You had barbed wires, trench networks, a lack of transport, mainly horses, but oftentimes humans, following the war, lighter and more destructive artillery pieces would be designed. Not to replace field guns and the like, but to simply add another card to the deck that would develop the more modern mobile warfare that we would witness during the Second World War. The T-1 medium tank prototype program would continue with its now newly mounted howitzer into the 1930s. At the direction, or maybe the insistence, of the chief of the Field Artillery Branch, Major General Harry Bishop, he insisted that the T-1 medium tank be up-engined to increase both the speed and power-to-weight ratio for what he considered to be the T-1 motor gun carriage, due to the pack howitzer now installed. In April of 1932, the T-1's Packard engine was removed in favor for, once again, the 338-horsepower Liberty engine, again, borrowed from the Mark 8 Liberty tank. This engine did increase the power and the performance of the T-1, which was now designated the T-1E-1 because it had a new engine. This allowed the T-1E-1 to move about at a maximum speed of 25 miles per hour, or 40 kilometers per hour. However, and now I want you all to say it with me, the Liberty engine overloaded the powertrain of the T-1E-1, just like it did with the previous M1921 medium tank trials, resulting in, quote, early failures, end quote. Ultimately, the T1E1 would finish testing at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds and was sent to Fort Benning, Georgia, where it was hooked up with the recently redesignated Company A 67th Infantry medium tanks. This was done to continue testing and war games alongside the M1921 and M1922, as well as the medium tank T2, which we will get to next. I'll be posting a great photo of the T1E1 in service with the 67th at Fort Benning. She received the nickname Fu Manchu, albeit by this time the pack howitzer had been replaced with the original 6-pounder, so go check out the photo, it's pretty cool. The ultimate fate of the T1E1 after 1932 is, at least for us armored enthusiasts, a rather sad tale. The T1E1 was sold for scrap, and that was that. Goodbye, old friend. We hardly knew ye. If you'll recall, just like we saw in the last episode with the M1921 and 22, along with Christie's own M1919 and 21 program, which ran parallel to one another, a lot of that going on, especially in these early days of the medium tank program. So, without further ado, we shall turn the clock back from 1932 back to March 11th, 1926. The prototype T1 has been approved. Alongside it, another medium tank project, which had been shelved earlier, but that book was now reopened on the Model 1924. The Model 1924 was a 15-ton medium tank under development at Rock Island Armory. Progress was slow going, hence the Model 1924 tagline. Even with the approval to continue work on this prototype, funding would be limited, like a trickle of a leak of a tiny pinprick in an already underfunded bucket. By 1929, the Model 1924 would be completed and redesignated the medium tank T2. This new medium tank, and let's be real here, 15 tons was not a medium tank. But for the sake of this episode and narrative, we'll play along. The T2 borrowed heavily from the T1E1 light tank, and before you at me, no, not that T1E1, and yes, the US naming conventions have quite a lot of overlap and can and will confuse things. You'll just have to trust that I will make the designations clear. That said, the T1E1 light tank was manufactured by James Cunningham and Sons, who famously, at least according to George Hoffman in his book, Through Mobility We Conquer, The Mechanization of U.S. Cavalry. Quote, James Cunningham, Son, and Company developed the M1 armored car, the T-24, and also manufactured the prototype T1 light tank, end quote. Though maybe more famously, James Cunningham and Sons should be remembered for the Cunningham automobile, one of the earliest production models of horseless carriages in the United States. From 1896 to 1931, James Cunningham and Son produced vehicles were typically of handmade nature, a standard practice at the time, which would also make them expensive and consumed a lot of man-hours to produce. We might have a chance to revisit this company at another time, but really, they only should have consumed a sentence or two in our story. Just know that they made some pretty slick cars and limousines in the early days of automobiles. Very luxurious. And by that, I mean they didn't even list the price of their cars. It was upon application, if that tells you anything about the clientele that would be able to afford these vehicles. I will post, however, a 1922 Model A limousine on Instagram for you all to gawk at. Ultimately, the company was sold to the Gleason Corporation before eventually that company being folded into something else. Anywhoozleby, this T1E1 light tank was essentially a tractor. It weighed in at 7 tons with a front-mounted engine, keep that in mind, Though the turret, transmission, and final drive were all located to the rear of the vehicle, with a crew of only two men, yes, two, a driver and commander/gunner/loader/exhausted tanker. The vehicle was armed with the Cannon d'Infanterie de 37, the Modèle 1916 Tir Rapide, Putois. Or for everyone else who would like to actually understand what I'm saying, sorry, France. The U.S. designated the weapon as the 37mm M1918 short tank gun. Much simpler and less of a mouthful. Fun fact, this quick-firing cannon was mounted on aircraft during the Great War. Yes, aircraft. 37mm cannon. It's crazy. Along with this 37mm, a Browning 1919 30 cal machine gun was also mounted coaxially in the turret. The T-1 project would last until about 1932, and they would go through several models. There was the T-1E1 all the way through to the T-1E6. Though none of these tanks would ever see combat, nor would they ever be mass-produced, it did, however, lend a lot of know-how to our T-2 medium tank, which is what we shall now be discussing. The T-2 medium clocked in at 15.5 tons, or 31,000 pounds. Powered by the 338-horsepower Liberty engine, borrowed again from the Mark 8 Liberty tank. With this engine, the T-2 sported a rather impressive ground pressure of 20 horsepower to ton, allowing the T-2 medium to pal around at a maximum row speed of 25 miles an hour, though, according to R.P. Honeycutt, quote, the maximum road speed of 25 miles per hour was limited to 20 miles per hour by a governor to extend the life of the running gear and powertrain components, end quote. Armed with a 47mm semi-automatic cannon, using the M4 combination mount, a 50 caliber machine gun was also mounted coaxially to accompany the main cannon. The gunner was forced to stand, at least originally. However, it was quickly realized that this was problematic, since the turret could rotate, but the man could not. To remedy this situation, a seat was attached to the gun cradle itself, allowing the gunner to stay on the weapon as it moved. This kind of created another problem, as the added weight of a man on the gun cradle required a counterbalance fixed to the barrel of the gun, right up against the gun mantlet. Secondary armament consisted of a 37mm cannon with a 30 caliber machine gun coaxially mounted in the right bow on the front of the vehicle. The T3E1 combination mount would ultimately be removed and replaced with a singular 30 caliber machine gun in the bow due to complications with the 37mm cannon interfering with the operation of the main gun inside the already cramped turret. There simply was not enough room to accommodate both the 47mm and a 37mm cannon within the T2 medium. Additionally, another 30 caliber machine gun would be added in 1931 as an anti-aircraft weapon. It was mounted as such on the turret roof. Armor protection, as it might be expected, was rather lacking, ranging from 7/8 of an inch, or 22 millimeters in real human terms, which would be the thicker part of the tanks and covering, you know, the crew compartments. The thinner part of the armor was down to only a quarter of an inch, or 6 millimeters, which, good luck stopping armor-piercing anything with that armor. Now, let us not forget that it is only, you know, the mid to late 1920s, you know, early 30s. We have to remember that all of this new technology was just that. It was brand new. This prototype T2 medium, which, I'll have to be honest with you, exudes some big-time M2 Stewart vibes. Maybe a little bit more on that later. And I'll have to post a photograph or two of this particular vehicle, since I'm sure most of you will probably agree with me. However, looks like and acts like are two separate things. The T2 may have kind of looked like a Stewart tank, but it was still designed to be a medium tank, And more realistically, it stole a lot from the British Vickers medium Mark II tank. What was it that Picasso said, or is alleged to have said? Good artists borrow, great artists just fucking steal that shit. Something like that. The Anglo-American interoperability and willingness to work in concert with one another allowed technology to be further stretched and experimented with. Obviously, knowing what comes in the future, we know that cooperation would become even closer during the Second World War. However, the two nations would diverge in their armored theories, doctrine, production, and what they considered good attributes. The British had their ideas of what constituted a good tank, and the Americans had their own version of what made a good tank great. That digression aside, the T-2 was very much so a product of its time. The crew compartment, and remember, the engine sat in front of the vehicle. So the crew compartment was this basically a rectangular box. Think of like a box van. It had two swinging doors at the rear to allow entry and exit of the vehicle. It was made of riveted armored plates. This crew box sat on a chassis, which if you removed all the pieces that make this a tank, i.e. the turret, you could take this thing down to the local tractor pool and nobody would bat an eye. It's basically a tractor chassis, with a metal box that sat behind the engine. So the front end of the vehicle slopes on the top deck down to a flat-facing nose or glacis. I know what you're thinking. A flat nose? What about those sweet curves and slopes you had mentioned in the last episode? Well, sloped armor was not seen as it would be in future tank designs. The idea of deflecting solid shot wasn't forefront in the designers' minds, at least not yet, you know? Instead, they needed, firstly, enough room to adequately sit the engine, as well as allow for ventilation, maintenance entry, and part replacement. Secondly, the front end couldn't be too long, too heavy, or interfere with the balance of weight characteristics. Okay, so this boxcar tractor flat-nose chassis sat a turret with the same appearance as that of the medium tank, the T1, or the T1E1. And even the earlier M1921 and M1922 tanks. It was cylindrical. However, the roof of the turret had those same, I want to call them inverse wings. So the left third and the right third of the tank on top of the center line, it sloped downward. I have to be honest here. I couldn't really identify any solid reason for this, at least not in writing. Now, I'm going to postulate here, and remember, these are my own amateur opinion, but I reckon that this was designed so that the commander, with his head above the cupola, could look down to the left or look down to the right on either side of his turret and get a better idea what was on either side of the vehicle, without having to expose his upper torso. Now, I don't really know for a fact that that was the intention, but really these sloping wings only served to make the inside of the already cramped turret even more so. If one of you happens to know, or you know, otherwise maybe you have a book that I don't, that has more design schematics with the intention laid out, please forward that along to me. I would love to know exactly why this turret design seemed to survive a few generations of these medium tank prototypes, but it's not seen in any of the serial production model of medium tanks moving forward. Last but not least, the gun mantlet on the T2, because of that added counterweight we spoke of, it reminds me of the latter heavily armored Sherman Jumbo. And before you jump at me, I know it wasn't called the Jumbo, but I'll bet if I said the M4A3E2, you might have had to look it up. But you know what the Jumbo is, or at least in my mind you do. The front of the turret does have a sort of a protrusion that lends the front of the turret to look almost stretched out. All right, so the T2 testing went on from December of 1930 through to the end of January 1932. And honestly, by all regards, this was the best medium tank the Ordnance Department had come up with to date. Albeit, you know, this is in a vacuum since the vehicle wasn't going to be sent overseas in any capacity. But as a prototype, it proved that it was feasible to produce a vehicle with high speed, good firepower, and great mobility. Though funding was a little tight in the 1930s. For those of you who might be unaware, there was a little thing called the Great Depression ravaging all of the United States and the rest of the world. So the Great Depression was a period of time in which, I'm kidding. We're not going to revisit fifth grade history here. I'm sure there is another podcast out there which is intimately involved with retelling that garbage time period in American history. What matters for our story really boils down to a simple problem. No money, no tank. So the T2 medium prototype would be a one-off, successful, for its time anyway, vehicle. Just like all of the medium tank prototypes of this era, it was used to test several different features. They removed the 37mm cannon, they added a 30 cal, they tried fitting a bigger cannon into the turret, unsuccessfully. However, the most impactful study was that the clutch brake system for steering was unsatisfactory for a vehicle with this much speed. You know, that speed demon tank that it was racing along at 25 miles per hour, or 40 kilometers per hour, needed a better steering mechanism. And thanks to the T2 medium testing, later medium tanks would have improved steering. More on that to come, but it is worth noting here that the Germans were still using the clutch brake style steering in the Panther, which, like a dead horse I keep bringing up and beating up again, we covered that in the previous series. Albeit with some additional features, it was still the outdated and problematic steering that in the early 1930s was determined to be too primitive and unreliable in a 15-ton prototype. Just some food for thought. The fate of the T2 medium tank was to be that of a museum piece. This vehicle managed to escape the scrapyard fate that several prototypes would ultimately face. And for those curious, it is currently on display at Fort Lee, Virginia, if you're ever in the area. Well, folks, thank you for being patient with me. I know this episode is coming out a day late, but it is a holiday weekend, and I was busy playing games with friends at a LAN party. If you've ever wondered what the most difficult thing in the entire world is, just try and get 5 30-something-year-olds together for 12 hours to do anything. Trust me, it was nearly a decade in the making, and a hell of a lot of fun. Maybe we'll have to host a Panzer podcast game day or something like that in the future. In other news, I've finally settled on a supplier of the Panzer Podcast official TM sticker. Well, at least the first of many designs. This first sticker is, of course, going to be the Panther. I will be posting a separate Instagram and Twitter post for those who wish to have a look. I am entertaining the idea of pre-orders at a discount. This will be before I set up my Teespring store and start selling them en masse. All the proceeds will go towards the podcast and improving it, along with allowing me to, you know, gather further research materials. You know, that means books, magazines, pictures, you know, things that generally give you, the listener, more fun tank facts. As always, I can be reached via email at thepanzerpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at thepanzerpod, and on Instagram at thepanzerpodcast. If you like what we're doing here, I would appreciate a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever. It does help us out, and I know I sound like a broken record, but I really do appreciate it. Until next time, I'm John Burgess. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.